go, 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 Gila, ha, ha, go. Patsy, go to Frisco, go to Fargo. Oh, keep an okey playing the possum on a pogo. Stick around and see Gila show. Go overland alive, a band of jive will blow, go, pogo. I go, you go, who go, to go, Polly, who go. A caravan, Diego, a Waco, and a Swago. Tweedledy, he go, she go, we go, me go, pogo. The Tascadero, we'll power someplace in Mexico.
Hello and welcome to the Comics in the Golden Age podcast. This is Mike, and this episode's going to be a little bit different in that I'm going to be discussing my recent trip to the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum in Columbus, Ohio. The main purpose of my visit was to see their exhibit, Into the Swamp, the social and political satire of Walt Kelly's Pogo, which was as great as I'd hoped, but I also got to see so much more than I expected when I went. Before I get into that, I should speak for a bit about what the Billy Ireland Museum is. The museum is located on the campus of Ohio State University, and its origins go back to 1977, when alumni Milton Caniff of Tarrying the Pirates and Steve Canyon fame offered to donate his papers to the university. Apparently, at first, the university declined because those in charge just did not see any scholarly value to a cartoonist's work. Fortunately, someone in the journalist department learned of this, and they offered to take it because of the newspaper connection. The university established the Milton Caniff Reading Room at the Journalism School, the first curator being Lucy Shelton Caswell. Other cartoonist papers were donated as well, as was the comic art collection of Bill Blackbeard, the largest collection of newspaper comic strip sheets and papers in the world. Other collections followed, and the reading room expanded and underwent several name changes. It eventually reached its current location in 2009 and took the name of Billy Ireland, another famous cartoonist who had attended the university and the mentor of Milton Caniff. I'll describe the museum's current setup later, but let me back up a bit and explain how my trip came about. I had known about the exhibit, which began in June and will be closing at the end of this month, for some time. I used to travel several times a year for my job, but the trips had been canceled for some time due to COVID. I was hoping that once they resumed in the summer, I could use one to get to Ohio and it would be my chance to go to the Billy Ireland Museum. That never happened over the summer, though, so I started to think I'd just end up missing the exhibit. However, last month, the museum posted a virtual tour of the Walt Kelly exhibit on YouTube. It was a wonderful video, not very long, about a half hour or so, I think. And in addition to showing parts of the exhibit, it had a number of cartoonists and other famous people who were heavily influenced by Walt Kelly, such as Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury, Jeff Smith of Bone, Jake Tapper of CNN. They even had an audio contribution from Bill Watterson of Calvin and Hobbes. I'm not going to say too much about the virtual tour, because you should check it out yourself. Just go to YouTube and search for Billy Ireland Walt Kelly Tour, and you should find it pretty quickly. Most of you listening to this podcast probably have at least a passing familiarity with Walt Kelly and his Pogo newspaper strip. But for anyone who doesn't, I'm going to read a little bit from the dust jacket of Volume 1 of Pogo by Walt Kelly, The Complete Syndicated Strips, which is the first volume of a series of collections that have been put up by Fantagraphics collecting the entire run. I believe they're up to Volume 8 now, although I'm still a volume or two behind. The dust jackets have a very nice little flowery summary that sort of put it together much better than I could. So let me just read from that. Walt Kelly created Pogo for comic books in 1942. The feature became a newspaper strip in 48, attained national syndication in 1949, and rapidly became one of the most popular strips of its day. Kelly's wit and flair for character comedy made Pogo a daily must-see on the newspaper funny pages across the land. Every cartoonist who later put social and political comment in a newspaper strip or panel would hail him as a master. Everyone who avidly followed his work would remember it and treasure it, and most of all, quote it. And from another section, from 1948 till half past 73, Walt Kelly's Pogo was one of the brightest spots on any newspaper comics page fortunate enough to have it. Bright in terms of its characters, colorful even in the black and white dailies, and bright in the sense of being witty and smart. It was a strip that presumed its readers were also witty and smart. And if you weren't, no problem. You could just look at the pretty pictures. Kelly's lush, organic style drew you into his swampland, and his lively cast of characters kept you returning. Walt Kelly is, without hyperbole, one of the greatest cartoonists to ever live. And watching the virtual tour got me very pumped up again about the idea of visiting the museum. So I decided, hey, I've hardly traveled over the last 2 years. I'm going to treat myself to a road trip to go. This was about mid-September, so I looked at the calendar to see what dates could work. Unfortunately, I found that the first week coming up was really the best one to go, as I was pretty tied up for the remainder of September and through October as well. So, within just a few days, I found myself on the road heading to the museum. Now, I did do a little bit of research before going and reached out to cartoonist Ben Toll, who I'd seen on Twitter had recently been there himself, to visit the Walt Kelly exhibit. I saw that they do currently have a reading room, and if you go on the website, it explains how you can set up appointments to go in and look at some of the stuff they have in their archives. At first, I got the sense it was directed more towards people doing research, which is how I tend to hear of these rooms in the first place. But a video the museum posted online made clear that anyone could schedule an appointment, and Ben Toll also assured me that that was the case. So then I had to think, out of the millions of pieces of art in their collection, what would I actually like to sit down and take a close look at? It did not take me long to decide, because the obvious answer was Milton Caniff. After all, they had the Walt Kelly exhibit, which would give me plenty of opportunity to see a lot of his art. So for the reading room, I went with Caniff. I reviewed what they had in their archives online and made a list that I submitted with my request by email to get an appointment. I'll talk in a few minutes about my visit and some of the specific pieces of art I asked to see. From where I live, the drive to the museum took about 6 hours, which might seem like a lot to some people, but was well worth it to me to get the opportunity to see original art by creators like Kelly and Caniff. My appointment in the reading room was early, so I went there before actually visiting the Kelly exhibit. It's a pretty big room with its own library and a dozen or so large tables. And on a cart they had sitting all of the pieces of original art I'd asked to see. They gave me a pair of gloves, because of course they do not want you damaging valuable art, and they also gave me a few large pieces of cardboard. Those were to sit each piece of art on to carry back and forth to the table. They asked me to only take one piece at a time and be sure to use the cardboard, which is certainly understandable given that they don't want you manhandling this stuff. As for what I was going to be looking at, I had asked for several Sunday pages from both Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon, plus some dailies. My choices were mostly random, and I had selected pages on the website that had jumped out at me as particularly well-drawn or interesting. But there was one I wanted to see because it was part of the famous storyline in Terry and the Pirates in which the character Raven Sherman was killed. It was not the strip in which she actually died, but it was several follow-up strips in which the characters Dude Hennick and Terry buried her and then slowly made their way down the mountain as Dude was dealing with her loss. Several of those follow-up dailies had been glued to one large sheet to make them almost appear like a Sunday strip. Given how huge that storyline was at the time, with readers writing angry letters to Caniff and the media doing news stories over it, I couldn't believe I was sitting there so many years later holding the original art in my hand. Although I couldn't believe that about any of this art, really. Another batch of strips I looked at were originals of the Bruce Lee strip that Caniff and Noel Sickles produced in 1977 that were never actually picked up by any syndicate. As a kid born in the early 70s, I grew up loving Bruce Lee, of course. So that was a treat. Although, looking back now, I think it was probably for the best that the strip was not published. Caniff's Terry and the Pirate stories in the 30s and the 40s were often not very flattering in their portrayal of Asians. And while there was nothing nearly as bad in the Bruce Lee strips, I still think he was of an age, and from a certain time, where Caniff was probably not the ideal storyteller for a Bruce Lee comic strip in the 70s. Nevertheless, it was great to be able to look at these originals, and to see what could have been. I also asked for a few other items, such as Christmas card art, a painting that he did, stuff like that. It was all just gorgeous. And some of the stuff I'd seen in books and online over the years, but never thought I would be able to hold in my hands, was there. That's the thing. I know these sorts of reading rooms are common, where you have any sort of archives. But since I was there purely as a fan and not conducting any sort of research, I kept expecting someone to tap me on the shoulder and say there'd been a huge mistake in letting me in. But no one ever did, and after a glorious 45 minutes or so of going through this beautiful original art, it was finally time for me to check out the Wal Kelly exhibit. I should mention that the museum is made up primarily of just three large rooms, so it's not that big, but on the other hand, you can cram a lot of comic art into three large rooms. When you enter the main room, the first thing you see is Chester Gould's desk. Yes, the drawing table on which he drew Dick Tracy for all of those years. It's old, it's beat up, it's scratched and marked and even burnt, and it's gorgeous. You can feel all those decades of blood, sweat, and tears when you look at that table. After that, the first room has a number of pieces of original art up that sort of trace comic strips throughout the decades of the 20th century. For example, two of the first pieces are from Winsor McCay's Little Nemo in Slumberland and Hal Foster's Prince Valiant. Now, seeing those two pages alone, even if I hadn't just spent almost an hour going through Milton Caniff pages, would have made my six-hour drive more than worth it. I mean, anyone who follows me on Twitter knows what a huge Hal Foster and Winsor McCay fan I am. But there was more in that room, including pages from Dick Tracy, Peanuts, Beetle Bailey. There was even a page of Jack Kirby art from Mr. Miracle featuring Big Barda. There were also a number of sliding cabinets that you could pull out to see more pages of original art. I saw one by Ernie Bushmiller. There was more comic book art as well, including the cover to Power Pack No. 2 by June Brigman. That was a surprising and unexpected treat. Now, the second room contained the Walt Kelly exhibit. Keep in mind that the theme is the political satire of the strip, so most of the art was in support of that theme. However, there was also some stuff just establishing the history of the strip, including an issue of Animal Comics, the Dell title in which the characters from Pogo first appeared, mainly Albert the Alligator and Pogo Possum. I'm not going to get into a big history of Pogo because you should really check out the virtual tour, and I'm just going to go through some of the stuff I saw. There are quite a few things related to Pogo's presidential campaigns, particularly in 1952 and 56. Not just original art, but also news clippings mentioning the response on college campuses, an I Go Pogo pin with the catchphrase for the campaign, and more. There were also a number of strips containing the caricatures of real political figures he included in the strip, which is something that Walt Kelly's Pogo is famous for. The most famous of those caricatures was Simple J. Malarkey, who was based on Senator Joseph McCarthy. Now, taking on McCarthy in the 1950s, of course, was a pretty ballsy move on the part of Kelly, and did get him some pushback from papers around the country. But, of course, history has proven him to be the one in the right. There were quite a few other political figures he parodied, including Richard Nixon, Nelson Rockefeller, Spiro Agnew, and J. Edgar Hoover. And he did not limit himself to just American political figures, as caricatures of both Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro popped up in the strip. Many examples of these satirical strips are included in the exhibit. There was also a strip from the pre-hysterical Pogo era, when Walt Kelly was paying tribute to cartoonist T.S. Sullivan. And this was a perfect time for me to appreciate that, since I had just recently finished Fantagraph's new book on the cartoonist, A Cockeyed Menagerie, The Drawings of T.S. Sullivan. The cartoonist, active at the end of the 19th century and the first few decades of the 20th, was a huge influence on Walt Kelly, as well as Walt Disney and many of the early animators at the Disney Company. There were various other things in the Walt Kelly exhibit, such as preliminary work on a cartoon with a pro-environmental theme that never got made. But I should take a moment to just discuss what it's like just seeing Kelly's original art. As many, many others long before me have pointed out, the swamp setting was just perfect. The way he drew it, the trees, the ponds, all the plant life is just stunning, and when you see it in its original form, you gain an even greater appreciation for his talent. And the animals as well. I know the dialogue in the Pogo strip is very unique, and definitely takes some getting used to. I know on my first attempt at reading Pogo, I struggled, and to be frank, I gave up for a while, and thought maybe this strip just isn't for me. But on a later attempt, it just sort of clicked for me in a way it hadn't before. I don't know why, but it did, and I fell in love with it. But really, regardless of the dialogue and writing, the art is magnificent from the first glance. So at this point, I had gone through the Milton Caniff art that they set aside for me in the reading room, and seen the Wal Kelly exhibit, the two things I was most looking forward to. But I still had a lot more to see, including the third room of the museum, which contained a really fun exhibit, The Dog Show, Two Centuries of Canine Cartoons. As is obvious from the title, it was a ton of original art from comic strips containing dogs, such as Little Orphan Annie, Blondie, Peanuts, of course. There were animation cells from films and cartoons. There was even a table full of comic books, from Rex the Wonder Dog to Lassie and much more. And this exhibit was just cute as hell, and very touching. After finishing all the rooms, I wanted to go back through the Wal Kelly exhibit again, but I was getting kind of hungry, so I decided to take a break. But first, I went back to the reading room, because before my trip, I'd posted about it on Twitter, and the person running the Billy Ireland account had asked me to stop by and mention when I was there. I was a bit nervous to do so. I didn't want to be a bother, which is why I waited and didn't say anything in my earlier visit. But I eventually built up to it. I introduced myself, showed the Twitter account, and mentioned the invitation. And they said they would mention it to the woman who ran the account, but it might take a while. I said, that's great, I'm heading out to lunch and I would return, which I did. When I got back, I spent a little more time at the Wal Kelly exhibit, taking pictures and really trying to burn the images into my memory. When I returned to the reading room, they indicated that she did still want to catch me before I left, but was stuck in a meeting. So I took the time to ask about the library in the reading room, and they explained that visitors are welcome to take any book to a table just one at a time and take as much time as they need with it. So I browsed for a bit and saw quite a few I'd love to read. But the one that really jumped out at me was the book that IDW put out a few years ago on Noel Sickles, which I wanted for some time but haven't pulled the trigger on yet. Now, I mentioned Sickles earlier in regard to the Bruce Lee project that Kniff worked on in the 70s. But Sickles was a tremendously talented artist who shared a studio with Milton Kniff early in his career. He was a big influence on Kniff, although he left comics in the late 30s to become a very successful commercial illustrator. I was thrilled to finally get a chance to check out this book, so I took it to a table and dove in. I probably spent about 20 or 25 minutes on it when Caitlin McGurk, the woman who had asked me to check in, came out to greet me. As I said, I was very nervous about seeing her because I didn't want to be a pest, but wow, she was so welcoming. Apparently, Ben Toll had put in a good word for me, and she'd appreciated my enthusiasm when I posted about coming. So then she dropped the bomb and asked me if I'd like to see their archives. After picking my jaw up off the floor, my answer was, oh God, yes, please, at least in my head. Hopefully my verbal response had a bit more decorum and dignity. She took me in the back, and the archives are just full of pull-out cabinets and shelves containing original art. And because I'd asked to see Kniff's work in the reading room, she immediately took me to a cabinet containing a lot more of his original art, which she let me look at for a while. And Caitlin asked me who else I'd like to see, and my mind immediately went to the greats like Hal Foster and Chester Gould and Charles Schulz, and she took me to cabinets containing their work so I could look at it. I'd also mentioned George Harriman of Crazy Cat, and she explained that they did not have that much of his, but when we went to look at Hal Foster's, I picked up a piece and underneath was a daily strip of Crazy Cat by Harriman, so I got to see original art from him as well. I should mention that, if I recall correctly at least, the organization in the archives appears to be based more on who donated the art and when. Don't quote me on that, I'm going by memory. But that's the way it's organized, more than being centered on a specific artist, which is why we stumbled on the Harriman art under Hal Foster page. Caitlin had gleaned from my Twitter page that I was also a fan of comic books and not just comic strips. She warned me that their focus leaned far more on the side of comic strips. However, she took me to a table that had a very unassuming box on it, and when she opened it, the first page was the Neil Adam Strawn page from Green Lantern 76 during the Green Lantern Green Arrow era, in which the elderly black man complains to Hal Jordan that he always cared about the orange skins and the purple skins, but never those with black skins. Yes, I got to see that page in person and even briefly hold it in my hands. There was other comic book art there, other pages by Adams from the same run, a John Buscema page from Conan the Barbarian, and more. I was stunned. The museum literally has millions of pieces of original comic strip art, many pieces of original comic book art, and there I was in the middle of all of it, looking at work by the greatest of the great. I went for the Wal Kelly exhibit, which was fantastic. I had the extra bonus of getting to hold and admire Milton Kniff's work up close. But now I was like a kid in a candy store, and I'm so grateful to Caitlin for taking me back there and showing me so many samples of what they had. There was one other thing I did there, which I haven't mentioned, which was a brief visit to the bookstore at the Wexner Arts Center on campus, which is very close to the museum. The museum does not have its own store, but this bookstore carries items related to museum exhibits. It's fairly small in size, but there's a lot of stuff shoved into the small space. I saw a number of cool items, which I only didn't buy because I already owned a lot of them, such as a collection of Little Nemo in Slumberland and Trina Robbins' recent book, Flapper Queens, on women cartoonists in the 1920s, which is a great book, by the way. But one thing I did not have that jumped out at me was a volume from IDW's Library of American Comics Essentials collection, which reprinted strips from Cap Stubbs and Tippy by Edwina Dumb. Now, these collections, if you've never heard of them, reprint about 2 years of daily strips by various comics from the 20s and 30s, like Crazy Cat, Baron Bean, Tarzan, Alley-Oop, and more. It's a great way for people to explore these strips at a time where the market probably would not support any major reprint series collecting entire runs. I was especially surprised to see the Cap Stubbs and Tippy volume because I've never seen one of the Essentials out in the wild. I'd only ever bought them online before. So I grabbed this one both as a souvenir for the trip and to help support the museum in some tangible way. So that was my visit to the Billy Island Cartoon Library and Museum. I initially went for the Wal Kelly exhibit and then to see the Milton Caniff art in the reading room when I learned that was a possibility. And again, both of those experiences were wonderful, but I ended up seeing so much more than I ever dreamed. And I do plan to go back. Next time I'm going for multiple days and spend much more time researching materials that I can see in the reading room from many more comic creators than I saw in this visit. Even within just a half hour of leaving, I was kicking myself for not asking if they had any original pages from Alex Raymond. And since then, I've come up with several dozen other creators in my head whose original art I would love to see. Well, thank you very much for listening to me talk about my visit. I hope it piqued your interest in the museum. Unfortunately, the Wal Kelly exhibit is ending this month. I would have podcasted about it much sooner if I'd been able to go, but I still wanted to share the experience. Even if you can't make it to the exhibit in this short remaining period of time, I hope you're interested in the museum itself. I know they likely have many more wonderful exhibits to come. I encourage you to go to YouTube and take the virtual tour on the Wal Kelly exhibit and keep an eye out for future ones at the museum. I think any fan of comic strips and comic history will find a visit as joyous and rewarding as I did. And definitely take advantage of the reading room if you go.